Here it is.
Again, we are very happy to have Robert Dahlgren here, and here we have part two of his lecture. Part three of his lecture on quantum curves and matrix models.
It's lecture two because we started lecture zero. So, if I kind of summarize that. The thing that we learned from last lecture is that matrix models and in general kind of topological strings, they give rise to curves, so there are spectral curves. So some curve, some algebraic curve. That in general was in this space where in some sense the two coordinates of the space could be thought of in the case at least of the matrix model. The x coordinate was the space where the eigenvalues of the matrix were living, and this kind of coordinate y was something a little bit more mysterical, but we also got in a very natural way living on the curve this one form y dx, and so that's how we somehow should have thought of the coordinate y. And I really also invited you to think of this curve lying in not any two-dimensional space, but a two-dimensional space that carries this kind of this holomorphic symplectic form. Now, having in some sense this space with a symplectic form that kind of begs to be quantized. So you might think, well, we quantize the space, in particular we quantize the space of functions living on this, and then of course the question is what happens to this curve. Now already intuitively you might think the following, just from classical mechanics you might think of this curve, this is kind of a Hamiltonian system with a single coordinate x and a momentum y, and the curve is something like a classical state. It is Lagrangian lying in the manifold, and then you might think that somehow the process of quantization will perhaps associate to this a wave function. More precisely, what you might think is that will happen is that the coordinate y, so we might want to look at the quantum mechanical system where x, y now are, say, some non-commutative operators when there's some constant here, h bar, and that means that we want to think of y as minus h bar d dx, and in that and then this function f becomes a differential operator, so somehow f of x and y we want to kind of replace by some differential operator, say, let me call it f hat, which is a function of x, and let me just call this del of x and del, and then you might think of looking at solutions to the equations f hat on psi equal to zero. In fact, there's perhaps an even better way to think about it, which is that in many cases these curves are literally spectral curves. So if you think of how the spectral curve appears, is that we have some matrix A of X, and then we can look at the determinant of say Y times 1 minus A of X. And of course here I have the picture that over X are the eigenvalues of the matrix. I mean, and they can do complicated stuff, and then this would be fxy would literally be the curve, the spectral curve associated to this matrix A. And if you look at it from this point of view, you can see that in some sense the most natural thing to do is if you replace y by basically becoming a non-commutative variable, that the thing to do is in some sense instead of looking at the matrix y times minus a of x is to look at the covariant derivative or this is some kind of in principle, if this is an n by n matrix, this would be some rank n holomorphic connection. In fact, it would be holomorphic and flat, because since this is a holomorphic variable, the curvature of this, which would be the commutator of d and d bar, is zero. So it's some flat holomorphic connection, and actually that's what I will be leading to. So some of this system is kind of begging to be quantized and be related to a theory of kind of non-abelian vector bundles with flat connections. So that's in the end what I will want to show, but what I will do now is actually I will kind of start from a very different point of view and think in terms of more kind of a physical system and relate it in the end to this kind of non-abelian system. So now we're taking a kind of a detour and look at a very, very different system, namely four-dimensional topological so-called n equals 4 Yang-Mills theory, supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory, and we will look at these four, this manifold on the four manifolds, say M4, which is a hyper-Kalen manifold, and we take as our gauge group UN. What's the gauge group? Now, if you have such a gauge theory, we can compute the partition function of this gauge theory on the four manifold. And this theory is set up in such a way that the partition function can be exactly computed in terms of essentially kind of counting the instantons or computing the certain invariance of the moduli space of vector bundles. So we have rank n vector bundles on this four manifold, and they generally captured by certain topological invariants. So we have topological invariants. In particular, we have the first Chern class P, which is an element of H2, and of course there's the second Chern, say the second Chern character for to be, which I call n, which is just an integer, and then this partition function is basically given by a sum over P and n of certain invariants, say d and p. So this is an invariant that's kind of formally defined as the Euler number, or a regularized Euler number of the moduli space of the instantons with these so there's some moduli space, some instanton moduli space with these characteristic classes p and n. And then you make a generating function, and generating function will typically look like e to the 2 pi I p times, so there's some variable, some dual variable v plus n times tau. Tau is the so-called gauge coupling constant of the gauge theory. So this, but from this point of view, you can just think of a generating function of these invariants, where I should say that in general these were integers. So this, that these are kind of believed to be integers, and in fact there's also usually nice to make here a small correction and write here c over 24 times tau, where this constant c is defined as n times, so n is the rank, times the Euler character of the four manifold m. So this is kind of this generating function. It's a function of two variables, tau and v. V is a vector-like variable. Perhaps I should have stressed this. And then there's a very powerful statement, namely that z is essentially a modular form. So this is a modular or effective Jacobi form for the group SL2Z acting on the pair tau and v. In particular on tau, it's acting in the familiar way through fractional linear transformations. So it's a very powerful statement. And I want to kind of explain a little bit from the physical intuition why this would be true. And in fact, the best way is to do this with a concrete example. And the concrete example I want to study, and actually will lead up to the theory of these matrix models and quantum curves in a moment, is that we take a particular four-manifold, which has been very well studied, which is a non-compact hyperKalin manifold. So we take for M4 a so-called ALE space, which is a quotient of C2 by gamma. Gamma here is a finite subgroup of SU2. And then we resolve it. So it's the resolution of this space. So this is a space, and I can take many subgroups, but often I take just the subgroup, the cyclic subgroup ZK, and then we have a quotient that can be resolved. It's a nice, smooth hyperKalin 4 manifold. And what's particularly important for us, if you have this manifold, that it has a boundary at infinity, and the boundary is the 3 sphere, which is the boundary of C2, quotient by the group gamma. So here we have a so-called Lens space sitting at the boundary. Now, if you consider a gate theory on this space, there's one extra ingredient, namely it's a non-compact manifold, and we have to say something about how the gauge connection, so I briefly mentioned this in my kind of lecture zero, we have to see how the gauge field, the connection on the bundle, approaches infinity, and it should do it. So in general, we compute against sometimes at self-dual solutions, but that the boundary should go to a flat connection, and a flat connection on this group is very simple. Namely, so we have to pick flat connection, which means that we have to pick something which is a homomorphism of this group gamma into UN. Or said differently, an n-dimensional representation of rho. Now suppose, indeed, that means that rho is a representation and it can be decomposed in certain multiplicities times the irreducible representation, so these are the irreps of gamma. It's actually good here to draw the Dinkin diagram associated to this finite group. So for instance, here would be the case for the group C6, and then it means that these are the Dinkin diagram, the nodes of the Dinkin diagram correspond to the irreducible representations of gamma, and so that means that we have certain integers n1, n2, etc. associated to these nodes. Well, here, as I also said, there's a beautiful theory, namely the so-called Mackay correspondence, that tells you that there basically is a very rich duality relating this finite group gamma to an affine Ketch-Moody algebra, which in particular, if you take for gamma, say, the cyclic group ZK, the corresponding Ketch-Moody algebra is the Ketch-Moody algebra whose Dinkin diagram is the one I pictured here, and so that would be in this case the group SUK. Now, if you look at representations of affine Lie algebras, they are given indeed by associating integers to each of the nodes, and then the sum of all the integers is called the level of the representation, the level of the affine Ketch-Moody algebra. So in general, this is central element in this, and the central element will have a certain eigenvalue, the eigenvalue called the level. And so, looking at representation, so if you look at the representation rho here, which is of dimension n, here we get a representation that we call rho hat. It's an infinite dimensional representation that is in this Ketch-Moody algebra SUK at level n. So, this is kind of a very interesting duality, and actually it's quite relevant here in this discussion. In fact, putting the gate theory on the singularity somehow brings this whole duality alive, because it allows you to construct the affine Lie algebra out of the finite group. And this was first essentially discovered and proven by Nakajima. So the claim is that if you do the gate theory partition function on this quotient of C2 by gamma, so we get some modular form, right? I already wrote it. So this is some function Z. So if you computers, this is as a function of T and V, then this is in fact the character of the corresponding representation of the affine Kac-Moody algebra. So the character of this representation rho hat of e to the 2 pi I tau L0 plus, and you say e to the 2 pi I V J0. Well, L0 is the usual V0 element acting in this Kac-Moody algebra, and J0 is the Cartan, the finite dimensional Cartan algebra acting in the representation. So this is in fact the character of this representation rho hat of this affine Kac-Moody algebra, again at level n. So is there some kind of a physical way to understand why this happens? And in fact there is, and I want to kind of present it now. So the idea is that, so we are looking at this, so for the moment let gamma now be the cyclic group ZK. And so then it means that our four manifold M4 is a so-called AK-1 singularity. That's the usual because the nice thing of these singularities is if you think of it in terms of a resolution, or you can also think of it in terms of a deformation, and they are actually equivalent in this very special case of these hyperkähler singularities. So now, in fact, this singularity can be viewed sitting inside a different space, the so-called Taubnet space. And a Taubnet space is a space which is not asymptotically Euclidean, but it's asymptotically flat. That is, at the boundary, doesn't look like R4 or C2, but it looks like R3 cross S1. So this is a space who has a circle, and the circle actually has a finite radius at infinity. So the Taubnet space looks something like this. So this is Taubnet. It has, if you wish, a circle vibration, and it's fibered over R3, but the fiber actually shrinks to zero at a number of points. Well, difficult to draw, but there are points, say x1 up to xk, where the fiber vanishes. And let me write down the metric. The metric has the following form. It's h times, say, dx squared. This is just the Euclidean signature, the Euclidean part, the R3 part, and here there is an angular variable chi. So chi is the coordinate that runs here, x is the coordinate that runs here, and then there's some kind of connection. And then this function h has the form 1 plus some x minus xi, where I runs from 1 to k. So these are the so-called nuts of the Taubnet vibration, and you clearly see h becomes infinite at these points, and that means that the size of the circle, which is this, goes to zero. So you can think of this manifold in some sense that here, say close to the tip, it looks like this singularity, C2 mod gamma, and here at infinity, it looks like S1 cross R3. So this is a space, and up to some details, you can think of, if you compute the gate theory partition function, you can also compute it here on this Taubnet manifold, and then you can take out the limit where the circle becomes very large. And since the thing is a topological invariant, it should not depend on the particular metric that you put here. This is in some sense a modulus here, which is the size of the circle. So you can basically take two limits. You can take a limit where the circle becomes infinite, so that's kind of all physics tricks and kind of mathematics. You take some object with a parameter and take two limits, right? So we have this Taubnet space, and with a certain radius here, and you can send this radius to infinity, and then you get the say the AK minus one singularity. Or you can send it to zero. Well, then you get some kind of funny thing, because what do you get? Well, you get this R3 with a certain bunch of singularities here. So how should you think about it? Well, in fact, string theory gives a very good intuition of how to construct a system. And let me explain that, and then we're getting close to the system that the spectral curves that we have been discussing yesterday. So here I'm using the language of D-brains. So I have to take, for the mathematicians here, that's the point where you have to kind of believe some of the pictures I'm drawing here. So what we want to study, we want to study this gate theory on the four manifold. So in general, what we would do, actually, you can think of this as taking the four manifold M4 across a circle and putting a so-called D4 brain on this. That's in fact N D4 brains, because that gives you a UN gate theory living on M4 across S1. And then there's a certain way in which this theory can be lifted to M theory. M theory essentially gives an extra circle, and here you get a manifold that looks like M4 across T2, so there's an extra circle. And on this system, you have manifold, you have a system of N so-called M5 brains. And where now, the nice thing is that there's a T2 appearing, and the T2 has a modulus, so it's, if you wish, an elliptic curve, and the modulus of this T2 is the variable tau that's appearing, for instance, in this partition function. So that, in some sense, explains why there is modular forms and elliptic curves are appearing. Now, we went from M theory to string theory by essentially picking a circle, in this case a circle in the T2, and compactifying the thing down to this D4 brain. But now we have not any four manifold. Our four manifold is this Tau-Glut space, and it also carries a circle. So there are kind of two choices of a circle that you can pick. You can either pick a circle in the T2, then you get just the four manifold back, or you can pick a circle in the four manifold and see what happens then. Well, if you do that, you suppose the four manifold was really fibered over a base, we would get here our base be, say, cross T2. But the point is that the circle vibration is singular over a number of points. So if we take for our four manifold Tau-Glut, so let's do it now for Tau-Glut, then what we're getting here is R3, which is nice. So we get a system of a gate theory and the four brains on this space R3 cross T2, but there are singularities, right? So here we have the Tau-Glut manifold. Here we have R3. But there are a bunch of singularities. And in fact, exactly at these singularities, you get some kind of a dislocation. And we know in string theory what the thing is. We get here brains, so-called D6 brains. So we get an interesting geometry. Like, let me picture the full geometry as you get them in string theory. This is in some sense not very relevant for the rest of the story to get this complete picture right, but it's important. So what we are claiming is that going through this duality, we can map the system, so we say a UN gauge theory on Tau-Glut is equivalent to the following system. So remember, we are in string theory, so we need a 10-dimensional space. We have N D4 brains. On which geometry? Well, on the geometry R3 cross T2. So let me picture it like this. So here is the T2. Here is the R3. And then at special values in R3, we have another brain, and the brain is actually like this. It's a point in R3. Remember, these brains are localized in a point in R3. And they cover the rest of space-time, which means they cover the T2, and then to make the whole thing right, there's also an R5 sticking out. So this, and in fact we have k of them. So we have k of these brains, and we have n of these brains. So it's a system of so-called intersecting brains, of sometimes also called I-brains. So how do you describe this system? Well, so it's important that these two brains, they intersect over the T2. And in principle now you have new degrees of freedom. So in general, if you have a bunch of brains like this and this, so let's look at the general situation where you have two sets of brains. So first of all, in general you have open strings, say living, say suppose this is the brain A. You have open strings with boundary conditions that they end on A. And in general these things can interact, right? So for instance, you could look at the three-point function of such objects. So this is an open string, this is another open string. And in general, what this will form, they will form an algebra. And in fact, in general, it will be a non-commutative algebra. Because in this, there's no way in which there's any kind of obvious symmetry. So for closed strings, where we have pictures like this, this is a commutative algebra. But in general, here, this will be some non-commutative algebra. It still is associative, yes. If you have a second brain, now you can have open strings which go from here to here. So let's call them brains of type B. And the same holds, so they form another algebra. So we get two algebras here. We get an algebra, say, curly A and curly B. Now, in our case, in this particular case of D brains, this is actually where we have a bunch of brains here and a bunch of brains there. We know what these algebras A and B are. Well, for one thing, in fact, they correspond to two gauge groups. And in this case, we have gauge theories, but in particular, we have two gauge groups. In particular, we would have here a gauge group UN. Remember, we had N of these brains living here, and we had K brains that were intersecting it. So we have gauge group UN and UK. But now, the moment you have intersecting objects, there is something else, namely there are open strings that go from here to here. So these kind of open strings here, so we get some new objects, let's call it M, which are kind of the AB strings. And if you just look at how these strings can interact, so in terms of boundary conditions, you draw something like this. So for instance, this is a string that goes from A to B. Now just in for instance, what we can do is we can put here again the boundary condition. So you see here again you have a string that goes from A to B. But here you have a string that goes from A to A. So already from the simple logic of these boundary, and of course there's another picture, which is kind of in some sense the mirror, where you see that you again have an AB string. But now there is what this basically tells you is that the algebra A is acting on the space of AB strings, and the algebra B is also acting on it. So the space of these AB strings, these interstrings that go from the one D brain to another, M is a bimodule. In fact, it's an AB bimodule. So roughly, cartoon version, closed strings give a commutative algebra, open strings or a single D brain gives a non-commutative algebra. If you have two of these, actually what you are producing is these intersecting strings, which are these strings going from one set to the other, and they form a module, or that is, they are a vector space on which the other two algebras act. So you get something which is a natural representation both for A, for the algebra A and the algebra B. Now in this particular case, what are we getting? What are these kind of these intersecting strings? Well, clearly that's something that's going from here to here, so you get objects where you have something which has, if you wish, is an n-dimensional representation for UN and a k-dimensional representation for UK. And this system has been analyzed in great detail. So this is a system which is so-called equivalent to the so-called D0, D8 system. So it's supersymmetric and etc. But so we know what the physical system is, namely here, what you're getting are chiral fermions, kind of on this space T2. So the system of these intersecting grains will produce you a bunch of chiral fermions. In fact, what you get a field theory. So we have these chiral fermions, and they carry indices, say, IA. IA, where I runs from 1 to n, and A runs from 1 to k. So we get a two-dimensional conformal field theory. It's living on this T2, so it's living on the elliptic curve. And in fact, it's a conformal field theory, and it's also something that you can explicitly compute. In fact, this is a beautiful system that's in some sense, in quite well known in the mathematical literature, because it's some kind of an affine version of the kind of the big, very familiar Schur-Weil duality. So if you let me mind, this is the way in which you link the groups, essentially the group UN and the symmetric group SK. And how do you do that? Well, you take the n-dimensional vector space, Cn, and then take the kth tensor product. Right, so you have k copies of Cn. And now you have the linear group acting on this. In fact, you have the linear group of rank n times k acting on it. But, of course, the point is now there are two commuting algebras acting on it. So this, if you wish, this can, you can decompose with respect to UN and with respect to the symmetric group. And then the nice statement is that if you, well, let's call this vector space F, that this kind of decomposes in terms of representations V tensor V, which are irreducible representations, where this is an irreducible representation of UN, and this is an irreducible representation of the symmetric group. So it's a good case where you have a nice module for two commuting algebras, very canonical case. And in fact, there's kind of an affine generalization for this, which is precisely the one that we are studying here with these free fermions. What do we have here? We have n times k free fermions. And this gives a representation for the affine Kac-Moody algebra UNK level 1. It's a level 1 representation because the level 1 representation of the affine Lie algebras is exactly in terms of free fermions. And now, these free fermions, so there's a big Lie algebra acting it, but there are two sub-algebras. Namely, in fact, it's better to write it in three. There's the SUN algebra at level K, which is also realized in that space. There's an SUK at level N, and then there's an extra U1 that you have to separate out. So there are three affine Kac-Moody algebras, and they're all sitting in this UNK level 1, and this is a so-called conformal embedding. By which I mean, if you compute the central charges of these representations, the three central charges, they add up to n times k, which is the central charge of this particular algebra. So the WCW models of these three add up to give the total central charge. And notice the following statement. If you look at this representation, so what is this representation? So if this is the module, so the usual kind of free fermion module, what we're now looking at, so you can think in the previous analogy, it's like the complex numbers, C. Remember, we took that to the power nk. Now, so here we do exactly the same. So if you take F and you take the nk tensor product, then the statement is that it decomposes. So let me for a moment ignore the U1. It decomposes in terms of representations rho tensors, where these V and W, V rho and W rho, so these are the irreps of SUN level K, and these are the irreducible representations of SUK level N. And let me remind you how you think of the irreducible representations of SUN level K. Well, usually you think of them in terms of Young tableaus. So you might think of this as being where the sorry, there are n rows as the representations of SUN, but the integrable representations of the affine Kapf-Moody algebra of level K have the property essentially that they at most of length K. So they are the Young diagrams that fit into a box of size n by k. And you can see now that this is a very nice property, there's a very nice duality here, which is in some sense even more beautiful than the usual Schur-Weil duality, because the symmetric group and the linear group have very different properties. But here you have two affine Kapf-Moody algebras. So these representations fit in a box of n times k. These representations fit in a box of k times n. And in fact, if you have a representation rho here, the conjugate representation is really the transposed. So you really take the mirror, some sense, where this is now n and this is k, and well, you get something else. So this is rho transposed. So there's a very nice theorem which tells you that this representation of the this free fermion representation decomposes in a sum of the irreducible representations of the algebra SUN level K tensor SUK tensor N level N. So both appear. Yes. Tensor products. Yes.
But they are fermions.
Yes.
But still,
think it's different. Well, what do you mean? It's just a Hilbert space. So the Hilbert space is not anti-commuting. But indeed, if you look at the algebra of the fermions, of course, they are anti-commuting. Right, so but it's just a tensor product of Hilbert spaces. Yes. So now we're actually quite close to understanding this result of Nakajima, because so first of all, I said what we are looking at some system which should be a bimodule for SUN and SUK. Well, you get it in a very nice way. And in fact, there's some very nice recent mathematical work about it. So Nakajima said essentially, remember, well, his results were much more precise, but also in some sense less exactly to the point. He said that if you looked at the space C2 mod, say ZK, and you do a UN gauge theory, then you expect to find a representation of SUK level N. So it's quite beautiful, but also slightly mysterious, that you do a rank N gauge theory, and you find a representation of a Lie algebra of rank K. Now, here you really looked at, so you have to be careful how to think about these calculations, because what you're doing, you're computing instantons or self-dual connections on this non-compact space. Now, there's a kind of a modification where you, in some sense, also keep track of the behavior at infinity. And this was already a long time a conjecture by Igor Frankl, that if you do that, that in some sense, not only this Lie algebra, but also the kind of the conjugate Lie algebra SUN level K should be visible. So in what you actually have to do is, in some sense, you have to do this theory and look equivariant with respect to the action of UN. And the conjecture was, if you do in some sense the equivariant computation, then the full, both affine Kac-Moody algebra should be visible. And in some sense, this kind of physics derivation in terms of this intersecting strings is very, very nice, because this makes this kind of completely explicit. So we can really see these representations appear. Now I want to somehow forget. So this story could be pushed much further, but I want to kind of now take a slightly different perspective and again kind of remind you of the general picture that we had. So we had the picture where we said, well, in some sense, what did we have? We had a curve. The curve in this case was our space T2. And it appeared as the intersecting locus of two class of brains. And then we saw that if you have such a system, then the fundamental objects, which are these intersecting strings, form free fermions. Now, this was particularly interesting, so we had the case where there was n brains of this type and k brains of this type, but there's no reason why we can't take the case where both n and k are equal to 1, which in some sense is doing gate theory on R4. So k equals 1. So this might be a little bit tricky, because what are the instantons on R4? But there is kind of a stringy regularization of that, and it makes sense to compute this. So we can in fact do the partition function in this case, and in fact this case is a classical case to do the partition function, because what is the partition function z? In this case it literally is the determinant of the del bar operator on this T2. And this can be written in a nice way, very explicit in terms of theta functions and eta functions. So this is given by a sum so this is the usual theta function, and then we divide by the eta function, where eta is the usual bosonic determinant. So eta function is product of 1 minus 2 pi I n tau n greater than 0. And so this can be given the interpretation of the determinant square root, holomorphic square root of the scalar Laplacian. So, in some sense, expressions like this we have seen before, in particular we have seen this. These were really the things coming out of topological strings, and where this, if you want to identify these things with the topological string partition functions, in some sense here we should see a contribution both at level at genus 0, which was this term over here, and term at genus 1. So we really see something quite remarkable. So if you indeed want to write this as, well, again, a sum over p of e to the power, kind of a term of genus 0 and term of genus 1, the genus 0 term is this kind of p squared tau, and the genus 1 term is the log of the determinant. So the curl fermions are in some sense to compute two things at once. Both the theta function and the eta function are coming at once, but the whole combination is given by the determinant of the del bar operator. So
here you could be an element of H2 also normalizable.
Sorry?
So here P is a flux which is...
Yeah, right.
It's so normalizable.
Yeah, so you have to... It's the non-normalizable thing. Exactly. Yes.
This is not defined as U1.
Sorry? It's defined as U1. U1, right? So there's always the U1 there, yes. So in some sense it's... It's indeed a theory on an A0 singularity, so not quite a singularity, but you kind of... what you're basically doing is you're replacing R4 by Tauchnot 1, which does exist. It doesn't have, of course, a singularity, but it has now... it has this circle rotation at infinity, and that's what you're keeping track of. So that defines the quantum number P. So in the Tauchnot sense, it makes sense. But I agree, if you think of an R4, it's somehow a stringy realization. But you see, now there's nothing that prohibits us from looking at this system in a more general way. In fact, we don't have to draw all these space-time dimensions. The important thing is that the one brain should at least include C2, and the other brain could be the curve C sitting inside it, so then it could kind of stick out. So we want to look at a system of two intersecting brains where, for all practical purposes, we can restrict to the complex plane. So one brain is living here, the other brain is intersecting it, and the complex curve, so as long as this is a holomorphic curve in C2, it has enough supersymmetry to realize these intersecting strings. So here we still get a system of free fermions on now this curve C. So you can do this too. And in fact, there's already an interesting gate system. So for instance, if you do the n equals 2 kind of Seiberg-Witten solution, you can again put realize this gate theory through various dualities in terms of a curve, and you get the same formula. And also there, you find that the Z is given by the determinant of the Dbar operator, but now, sorry, the determinant of the Dbar operator, not in general on this torus, but could be a general hyperelliptic curve. So now the question is, can we in some sense engineer a system that is really producing for us not only the determinant, only F1, but kind of is the full, complete equivalent to the full quantum system? And the statement is, yes, you can. So there's a chain of dualities that I won't review. But that basically tells you that the string coupling constant in these systems corresponds to including a B field, which is the form dx dy divided by lambda, where lambda was the string coupling constant. So what we are now going to do is we really are putting, if you wish, the symplectic form here. And what will this do? This is very closely related to all the beautiful constructions that, Sergei, you and others have written, and Kapustin have been doing in the context of geometric Langlands, all the recent applications. But what you're doing at the moment, you include kind of this coupling constant B. It means that, say, we had this algebra A, which were these strings living on this single brain, which were essentially the living on the xy plane. So there was an algebra. In the case of a system of rank 1, so there was an algebra, let me call it algebra A, which you can think as the space of functions, of holomorphic functions on C2. So that was just the algebra of functions in x and y. Now the moment we include this B field, this space will actually deform, and it will give a non-trivial commutator to the elements x and y. So that means that we now have to think of y as ddx, and so the algebra that we're now getting, the algebra A here, is the algebra generated by x and ddx modulo this condition. So that's the, if you wish, the sheaf of differential operators on the complex plane. So here we had kind of functions of x and y. Here we now get more, let's say, differential operators. So we get some D, which is in principle some combination, say, pi of x di. So we get a sheaf of differential operators. That will be becomes our algebra. And now what about these open strings? The open strings, in general, are something that, as I said, lives in a module for the algebra A. So kind of the intersecting strings. Which were our fermions, psi of x. Nay, they now become a module for, well, in general, the module for that algebra A, but the algebra A will now be the space of differential operators. So this is in some sense very, very canonical construction. Now, what does that mean in practice?
Lambda is the topological string coupling.
Lambda is the topological string.
It's not physical.
It's not the physical, no. No, so it's in general, if you in the physical context want to reproduce the topological string, the topological string coupling constant is the flux of a certain field. So in fact, what you do, there are many realizations of the topological string, but you include some flux of some Ramon-Ramon field in general. Then you have to follow it through the dualities. And then after all the dualities, it ends up to be a Nipper-Schwarz B field on this plane. And that has a familiar effect because it will make the ring of functions non-commutative.
And you know the general curve C?
Yes.
So what what represents the hyperkähler? Okay, what represents ALE?
So remember in the end, so I motivated this by starting with ALE space, but in the end basically we took A0 singularity, just took C2. So what we're doing, and we can consider gate theories just on R4, but different kind of gate theory. Right, so in some sense we're modifying the curve, we're not modifying the, so you could still, this would also do this on an ALE singularity, where you in some sense get a rank N system. But in general what we're modifying is the curve, which means, think of this as the Cyber-Quinton curve.
Yes, so yes. In order to engineer it, what's the data in string theory?
Choice of the curve.
So the geometry?
Yes. Well, of course, it depends on which duality frame we are setting, but in general, you know, you would do like geometric engineering or something with this curve. Yes. So another question is, in some sense, how does this kind of non-commutativity enter? And so, let me make a little detour and then we're done. So, in general, I have to remind you of the way, one way to think about free fermions and tau functions. So usually the thing is the following. So you have a Riemann surface, a curve, and what you do is you pick a certain point, P, and you pick a local coordinate around it. So P is the point, so in the local coordinate Z, this sits at infinity. Now, what you do is the following. So essentially, what you want to do is you want to compute the determinant of the D-bar operator on C. In fact, what you might want to do is, in fact, you might want to pick some extra condition. Perhaps you want to pick a line bundle here with a connection. And so perhaps you want to compute this determinant as a function of the choice of connection on it. So the Grassmannian gives a different way, so this is the thing that we want to compute, our partition function G, but there's another way to compute it, and that's the following way. So remember, if you have free fermions, usually they have some mode expansion, let me write it like this. So there's a usual expansion. And the psi ends, and so you have a dual field, psi dagger, and then there are usual anti-commutation relations. And then you build a representation of this algebra. So this is, if you wish, U1 at level 1. Then you build a Fock space. So how do you build the Fock space? Well, you start with a vacuum. The vacuum has the property that it's killed by the modes psi n and psi dagger n if they're all positive. And then the Fock space is made by acting with say a product of psi minus n and say a product of psi minus m dagger on the vacuum. So it's an infinite, so-called infinite wedge representation. So what you now can do is the following. So fermions are, this fermion is a half differential, so you can think of psi of z as being a section of the spin bundle, so the square root of the canonical bundle, an operator valued section. But what you can do is the following. You can say, suppose you have some other section of this bundle, then you can look at, let's call it psi of f, which is the contour integral of f of z psi of z. And for instance, if you take for f of z z to the n, then psi of zn, I think, is, or perhaps n plus a half, always forget, then this becomes precisely the mode psi n. So now you can associate to this data the Riemann surface together with the point P. You can associate another state C, and the state C is defined as follows. If you take psi of f on C, this is zero if and only if f is what? Well, f should be a function on the Riemann surface that's regular everywhere except around the point P. So you can think of this as a holomorphic function of C minus P. So one way to think about this is if the curve, so here's our point P, if this is just a sphere, so if this is P1, so minus a point, so we can think of this literally as the disk. So the disk is defined in the sense that what are the regular functions on the disk? So the regular functions are the function zn with n positive. And so to this corresponds, so what we mean is that in some sense all the modes of the fermionic field which are regular over the disk, they kill the state. It means that they extend. So here we get the corresponding state is just the usual vacuum. But you, if you have a more complicated geometry, so if C looks something like this, what we're now doing is we're looking at the functions here closed in this local coordinate Z, and we say that each function that holomorphically extends over the whole Riemann surface plays kind of the role of these modes psi n that kill the state, and so these functions in some sense define the operator, the state C. And now, essentially, the duality between the Hamiltonian and the Lagrangian formulation of quantum field theory makes a very powerful statement. And it says that this thing can be written as the inner product between two states, namely the state vacuum and the state C. So there are two where here both 0 and C are elements in this fermionic Fock space. In fact, there's something nicer what you can do, is you can, in fact, allow connections here that have arbitrary singularities around the point P here. And so you can do the following.
So in the sphere, C is equal to 0.
In the sphere, it's 0. So then it's 1. It's not a very interesting function. And in fact, what you can do is you can kind of modify the behavior at this particular point. So in some sense, it makes sense to write a so-called state T, which is the exponential of some Tn alpha minus n on the vacuum, where alpha minus n is the current, so it's psi k dagger psi minus k minus n. And now you have a state T, and now you can define something more complicated. So now, in some sense, we have the determinant of the del bar operator as a function of this parameter T's, and the parameter T's are encoding the singularity of the connection around here at this point infinity, and now this is actually the inner product of the state T and C. And there's a beautiful statement, so this is related to the theory of integrable hierarchies. So there's a very nice statement. So the first statement is that, say, so this function, so let z of t, is a so-called tau function of the Kp hierarchy, so that's a big hierarchy of differential equations, for any w in f. Almost, so generically, there are lots of specifications, but typically for a generic state in the fermion Fock module, this inner product solves, gives a solution of the KP hierarchy if this W is the state coming from a curve, which is in some sense, that means it's a determinant of a Debye operator on a nice Riemann surface, then these are so-called geometric solutions. And so, usually go under the name of Kirchhoff-Ehr. Also, sometimes they're called the periodic ones. Essentially, what it means is that this, we know that determinants of this Debye operator, essentially there's also a theta function. So these are given by essentially by theta functions. But there's another class of these solutions which are coming from matrix models. So now the statement is the following thing. If we have a D module, where I said a D module is in some sense explained in the beginning, the D module is a non-commutative version of a Riemann surface. So what is it? Well, in words, it's a vector space on which we have a representation of the space of differential operators, x and ddx. Now, it's very easy to make examples for this, so let me just give you one example and then you will understand how to think about it, which is actually almost a kind of a trivial example. So let me write down an example of such a curve. So suppose we have a curve y squared is u of x. So what I'm claiming now is that in some sense this gets modified. So this is a curve. The D module is essentially coming from the equation d squared, the differential. So this was a function. Now we have a differential operator, say d squared minus u of x. That's kind of the differential operator we're looking at. And what you clearly want to do is like a Schrodinger operator, you would like to look at solutions of this. Now, what you now can do is you can look at, you want to represent the algebra of, so what is the module? In this case, so think of a formal solution of this equation. Now the module, say M, consists of what? You can think of it as the all possible differential operators acting on psi. So here D is an element of this ring curly D, which is the space of all differential operators. So what does that mean in practice? Well, it means in practice the following. You have your fermion psi of your solution psi. You can look at x of psi, x squared on psi, etc. Then you can look at D on psi, and you can look at xd on psi, etc. But if you look at d squared, then clearly d squared is given by u of x. So d squared on psi is equivalent to u of x on psi. And so this already we have had. So what you see is in this, this says it is a space that is in some sense spanned by all the monomials 1, x, x squared, and d, x, d, x squared. So we get a vector space. And so this is our module M. Now, if you have such a D module M, what I now claim is that we can again define a state. So now I can get a state, let's call it M, which is defined by the property that psi of F on M equal to zero, where F, remember in the geometric case, F was a function that extended holomorphically on the Riemann surface. Here we don't have a Riemann surface because we have this more abstract non-commutative object, but we still have a representation of it, which is the space M. And now essentially what I'm claiming is that we can define the state M by the property that F is an element of the module M. So in some sense for every element in the module we can make a fermion operator, and if the operators kill the state. So the way I think about it is that, well, what we want to do is we have here our local coordinate Z, and we have a space of functions, and we want to say, well, how is the state in the fermionic space defined? Well, in some sense, by that it's killed by the operators which are made of functions which can be extended to some sense over this non-commutative object. And so, precisely belongs to the module. So, well, I don't have time, but I'm claiming that this is actually something that is already that's somehow built in the theory of matrix models. It was known at least for some of the so-called double-scaled matrix that you, David, know very well from the beginning. If you remember what we knew, just to remind you, is that so kind of in the old matrix models, they were characterized by two differential operators. So in general, you had some differential operator P and operator Q with the property that the commutator of P and Q equals 1. And one way to think about it is that, what do you mean by this? Well, P and Q, these are differential operators that can act on the space of functions of a single variable. So they act on the space of functions of the variable X. And the fact that these P and Q are commuting to 1 means that you have a representation of the sieve of differential operators, namely, what is that? So that sieve is generated by X and L. So if you have a representation of the sieve of differential operators, you need, so suppose now we have some representation, then basically what we are sending is that this pair of generators is being sent to the differential operators P and Q. So that these structures of Heisenberg algebra sitting in matrix models, well, it's a completely separate story to explain, but in some sense this fits very well. So in some sense this is not quite satisfying, because I would like to kind of define, so we had kind of two definitions of this kind of partition function. The nice geometric one is determinant of the D-bar operator. It's completely covariant. This definition, in terms of the kind of the Hamiltonian formulation, where you see it as an inner product of two states, is slightly not covariant, because you have to pick a point on the Riemann surface. But in fact, this definition then allows in a very natural way to this kind of non-commutative structure. So I'm basically claiming that these non-commutative fermions, they have something like a determinant, and the determinant is this inner product. So in the end, I should write the final result is then that this partition function Z that we want to compute, say the partition function of the matrix model or the partition of the topological string, is this inner product T of M, where the state M is now coming from this D module. So that's then in the end, in some sense, the fermionic formulation of these quantum curves. And so I'm claiming that in this big Grassmannian of possible fermionic states, there's a very small locus that we knew that corresponded to geometrical curves, but it's like a thickening, there's like an H-bar deformation of that where the non-commutative objects are sitting. And who knows what other kind of deformations there are. But in some sense, these are the natural objects to consider. So I think I want to stop here. Thank you.
Matrix models and fermions sort of came about through Eigenvalues.
Yes.
When triples
right.
Had many fermionic features from the sort of the beginning.
Yes.
So this D module.
It's in some sense it's sitting in there. So if you think about these operators P and Q, they were sitting there. But of course the point is that you see what you have to do is you have at the one hand take the infinite n limit and then think of the 1 over n corrections in terms of basically h-bar corrections. Right? So in some sense you first have to take the large n limits and then. And that's the tricky part. So if you would, but otherwise you would say, well, start with a 1 matrix, a matrix of rank 1, right? So that's kind of a very boring system. It's a single integral. So how can you get this out? So but indeed, well, I mean, at least I do understand that very clean. So there are two cases I think I understand well. One is this kind of double-scaled cases where this p and q very naturally appear, but of course there they take the large n limit. The other one is the Gaussian model. So also in the Gaussian model, because you know p and q are really x and ddx in terms of the fermions living on the original picture. And another thing which I think is interesting, that what this suggests is that so you missed that in the beginning, but so there's a question: how do you, what is in general the structure of such a D-module? And so there's a statement. So these are so-called holonomic D-modules, and in general, in fact, what it, the theorem tells you that whenever you have such, or you think of this curve, what it always is, it's always a non-abelian connection on X. So if this is the curve, we say of an n-fold cover, that the structure that you really want to look at is an covariant derivative, where this is an n by n matrix. So this should be hidden also in the matrix model. For instance, for the single matrix models, which are that's a hyperelliptic curve, so it's a two-fold cover. So there should be, in some sense, an SL2 system sitting in there. And that's something we know, because if you remember the action of x and ddx on the eigenvalues, it could be written as a kind of a 2x2 block at some point. So there is a kind of a natural SL2 structure sitting in there. But I mean, that's something I haven't really pinpointed. But so in general, the general theory of D-modules tells you namely that you can always think of these D-modules as kind of non-abelian flat connections. So SLN connections.
Question: in the n equals 2 case,
yes.
When you compute the partition function, you also have observables.
Yes.
You have to insert to get some non-zero contributions. So these observables, they have an interpretation in terms of your model of chiral fermions you wrote down.
So why do you say that? Because
I was just thinking about the case of Donaldson invariance.
Yes.
When you write down the partition function, you also have to insert observables for the zero elements or the two.
Well, not always, right? So one thing is that one thing that you can compute also in Donaldson theory is you. So if you don't put any of, so in some sense you're right. You can include observables, etc. But there is also something you can compute without observables, namely there is a term in the Donaldson theory. So if you put it on a curved four manifold, there is in some sense a term that goes with the essentially the Euler number of the manifold. So there is some kind of quantum correction that goes like e to the power f1, and then you know, there's the integral of trace r by r essentially over the four manifold. And this coefficient is there even if you not include any observables. So there is a contribution that basically goes exponential of the Euler number times this. And in fact, this is given by this log of the eta function. So, for instance, I think that's always there, even in the Donaldson theory.
My question was, if you have the observable,
yes,
then you get the generating function,
right,
including the observables, and whether they are still like an interpretation in terms of the...
of the fermions.
Yeah.
Well, I think so, yeah. There's work of Nekrasov which points to that direction, that in general you can indeed include... in fact, there's, of course, a whole zoo of observables that you can compute in the free fermion system. Yeah, and they should be able to... So in some sense you can write a much bigger generating function. And that should all have an interpretation in the gate theory. Some of them are these Donaldson observables, yes.
Any more questions? And that's the last.